Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So it is the last episode of the year. We are saying goodbye to 2020, and we're going to hunker down until the new year here at Heritage Radio after this week and maybe reflect on this tumultuous year. So this time of the year, you're bound to see a lot of best of 2020 lists floating around. So like best books of 2020 or favorite cookbooks of 2020. The author that I'm speaking with on today's show has made it to a lot of those lists lately. And I don't think I've mentioned it here yet, but I also published a cookbook too this year called Sheet Pan Chicken. And we had a fun, there was a fun article in New York Magazine's The Strategist that asked different cookbook authors to recommend their favorite cookbook. And I recommended this cookbook, and then she in turn was on it, and it was like a whole daisy chain. So it was a lot of fun. But I'm just so excited because if I were to weigh in with what my favorite food books of the year were, you basically are looking at it in this show. So every single food book and author that I've spoken with on Eat Your Words in 2020 has written one of my favorite food books. So we kicked off the year with Dara Goldstein's Beyond the North Wind, a beautiful cookbook about Russian food and lore. Along the way, you know, over the summer when the pandemic hit, or in the spring when the pandemic hit and we were staying at home and recording from home, which we are still now, I interviewed a lot of cookbook authors, or sorry, not cookbook authors, but erudite experts like Dr. Marcia Chatelain, whose book Franchise explored the fraught relationship with Black American fast food, and folks like Tom Philpott, whose book Perilous Bounty explored our fraught farming system in America. So a lot of food books to share on this, at Heritage Radio Network and from other shows on Heritage Radio Network. So while you're making your wish list or while you're buying presents for everybody, I hope you check out all the books that we've explored because they're really, really such gems. And I'm so excited to cap it off with a really, really great book. It's called Coconut and Sambal, Recipes from My Indonesian Kitchen. And its author, Laura Lee, is on the line with us now. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for listening to that long sort of plug for every single book on the show and winding up with yours, my Coconut and Sambal. It's such a gorgeous book. And I have to say that I love how this book, it fills this hole in my shelf where Southeast Asian cookbooks sort of jump to Indian cookbooks. Crossing over Indonesia. And, but it does so, so well. Like you do a really beautiful job of taking on this, great task, both through your writing and great photography. And I just have to imagine it must have been really intimidating to wrap your head around, you know, Indonesian cookbook. Was it like that for you?
Yes, definitely. I really wanted to write this cookbook, and I was going to write it whether someone was going to publish me or not. It was a very personal mission to really what I wanted to do and what I wanted to see in food media was Indonesia have its moment. And I think there's been a list of incredible ambassadors of Indonesian cuisine over the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades, mm-hmm. you know, slowly bringing it into the food world and, you know, globalizing it, but it still hadn't had its time yet. And for me, because I'm half Indonesian, I really wanted to celebrate the dishes that I grew up with. But it did feel like a large leap to think that a publisher would want to publish it, because I guess Indonesian food in certain regions like the UK or a lot of areas of the US, there's not a large Indonesian population. It's not a food that's very well known. So was there a market for people to want to cook and consume this food? But luckily, a publisher believed in the idea and went with it. And I think, you know, what COVID has done is, you know, created these kitchen travelers, people who want to travel through their cookbooks, you know, people who want to travel and taste different flavors and visit the holiday destinations they didn't get to go to through food. So I think, you know, that's been a wonderful part of writing the cookbook and seeing it how well it's done today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned you have an interesting background. You are based in London now, but you grew up in Australia and you're half Australian, and you describe yourself as half Indonesian or Chinese Indonesian.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. My dad is Chinese Indonesian. He came from Timor originally, which is one of 17,500 islands of Indonesia. And so he immigrated to Sydney, Australia when he was 22 or 21, I think, to go on a great adventure. He kind of went from being this kid riding a motorbike, you know, on a dusty track, you know, buying durian from the street side sellers, to kind of going to Sydney, where his English was okay, but, you know, definitely, you know, had quite a thick accent and a strong, not a great sense of what Australian life would be. And so he really, you know, for him, it was what a journey to have come to a country with kind of nothing and to have built up this wonderful life. And so he met my mother in the 1970s. They fell in love and were married 6 months later. And I guess the rest is history. But yeah, so in terms of my childhood, I grew up in Sydney. My dad's mother came to live with us when we were little. And my access to Indonesian culture was through Indonesian food, because when we were little, we were too poor to visit Indonesia, to travel there as a family. So the only notion I had of Indonesia really was through the stories that my grandmother and my father would tell me, and through the food that my grandmother would put on the table. So I've kind of carried all of those wonderful food memories with me into adulthood. And I guess that's really what you see in the book that you see today. Mm.
It's lovely. I love how you go to such lengths to describe some of the major hallmarks and tenets of Indonesian cuisine. Like, for instance, the title itself, coconut and sambal. These are two important elements of Indonesian cuisine, right?
Yes, definitely. And I think when I was researching the cookbook, it was a real struggle to think of what the title would be, because Indonesia, as I mentioned before, has thousands and thousands of islands. Each like area is very regional with distinct flavor characteristics. You know, there's different climates. So there's volcanic soil, there's beautiful beaches, there's swampland, there's really everything. And so in terms of trying to define Indonesia by a particular dish and there are some national dishes certainly, but it is very much a regional cuisine, and everywhere you travel, it might be spicy or sour or a sweet area or a very fresh area, or, you know, an area that loves its seafood and so on. So what I did, I kind of, you know, sat at the Indonesian table and I was looking at it thinking, okay, well, you know, what unifies this cuisine? And what I realized very quickly was that no matter where I traveled, there was always sambal on the table. So sambal is a hot chili condiment that Indonesians eat with every bite of food. So, you know, it exists to complement a meal as opposed to overpower it. But, you know, it can be very, very spicy or a little bit mild. But, you know, the sambals are very regional. You know, wherever you travel, they'll have their own distinct regional sambal. But there will always be sambal on the table.
Like salt and pepper, right?
Exactly. Or like mustard or ketchup. So you'll just find it on the table, and it's kind of used. They use it to kind of season the food, enhance the flavors. It's just wonderful. And the other element is the coconut, because the coconut palm grows all over Indonesia, and Indonesians have a no waste philosophy. So every part of the coconut is used, from, you know, the coconut water is drunk as a drink, coconut milk is made by exactly grating the coconut flesh and then, you know, mashing it with water to create coconut milk. You've got the coconut flesh in desserts. You've got the coconut shell is used as utensils. The coconut husk is used to fragrance smoke as it's like firing sake. I mean, everything is used, and even the discarded grated coconut is used to scrub stains off tiles and floors and cement.
Oh my gosh.
And it's just incredible. So, I mean, those were these two elements, and rice, of course. Rice is always on every table. So those were the elements that I really found on every table. So it just completely made sense to me to call the book Coconut and Sambal, and two such important elements of the cuisine.
I think there it's a really great title. It's very evocative. It makes me hungry. And I have to ask Laura, is the green cap sambal olek, like I've just always had that in my fridge. Is that acceptable in your opinion, or should I make my own sambal?
Oh, look, you know, I have a couple of sneaky jars of emergency sambal olek in my cupboard too. So, hey, don't worry. But, you know, for me, sambal olek is essentially, it's the most basic of sambal. So if you made it yourself, it would be boiling some chilies in water and then grinding it in a cobekan ulekan, which is like a kind of like a stone mortar and pestle in Indonesia. And then you would just season it with a little vinegar and a little bit of salt with some oil. So it's a really basic kind of sambal, and it's eaten all over Indonesia. So the ones that you can buy in the jar certainly has that essence of that very simple, you know, kind of it's got no tricks or bells or whistles kind of sambal. It's like it's salt, it's chili, it's vinegar. But I think what I love about homemade sambal is that there is a lot more complexity to sambal, and you have, you know, there
it's
are some
fresh.
That are exactly, and there are some that are flavored with the tamarind, others flavored with kaffir lime leaf. There's others that are flavored with you know, obviously shallots or ginger or galangal, and so many different types of flavor profiles. So I think it's definitely fine to use the store-bought, but I think once you make your own, you can make them and batch cook them, which is what I do. And then I pop them in jars and keep them in the freezer, and they last for months in the freezer.
Okay.
And, you know, a couple of weeks in the fridge. So
I can
that's
do that.
How I do it. Yes. Yes.
All right.
That's my suggestion. And it really only takes, honestly, like 15, 20 minutes to make your own sambal. You just need to buy a lot of chilies. And I think a food processor comes in handy. So I use a food processor as opposed to grinding it myself.
Oh my goodness. Okay. I'm sold. I love how I'm learning a lot through this book about like techniques. And one element, I guess, of cooking or good cooking sense that you described so beautifully is this notion of wangi or wangi, is it aroma?
Wangi. So wangi is this word that really represents, it means like the perfume of something. So if something is wangi, you smell the fragrance or the perfume of a dish or even of a woman, or, you know, the wangi is a perfume kind of fragrance. In the cooking process, when you're cooking a spice paste or getting a dish to the point where you know that it's, let's say, ready for the next stage, so perhaps you need to add coconut milk, but you need to cook off that spice paste first to make sure that it's cooked through, the rawness is kind of gone. You want to have this moment of the most powerful moment of that fragrance of wangi. And so when I was learning from home cooks across Indonesia, we would have this moment where we would bow our heads to the wok or to the pan or whatever kind of tools we were using, and just constantly just smell that fragrance. And I mean, this is something that people do universally, of course, but the word that they use to describe that moment is wangi. You know, it's wangi. So it's just, you know, your mouth is salivating because the every single flavor of that spice paste is just jumping out of the pan and leaping, you know, and into the air. It's just wonderful.
I love that. I love how you describe that. And it sounds like, so when the hot oil is sort of cooking those spices. Would you call that like tempering the spices, or I don't know, blooming them? I've heard that word.
Yes, I love that word, blooming. That's a great word to use. I love that. Yeah. So what I find when I cook the spice paste is that you kind of pop the you get the oil nice and hot, or like kind of like a medium high heat actually, because you don't want to burn it. But then you add the spice paste, and then as it cooks and as the liquid is evaporating from the sambal or the spice paste or whatever it is you're cooking, you'll find that the oil splits again from the ingredients, and that's also a really good indication, along with the wangi, the fragrance. Yeah, it kind of splits out of the spice paste, so you kind of see the oil kind of oozing out of the spice paste and kind of running around and doing its own thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, so it's no longer this kind of unified kind of like everything's just in the wok. The oil just starts to seep out at the edges or rise to the top a little bit, and then that's another good indication that your spice paste has been cooking enough. And you know, it usually only takes about 15 minutes to get that spice paste cooked off. That's my trick, but I think everyone probably has their own way. So, and that's the trick I learned from my a lot of the home cooks in Indonesia as well.
Right. Mm. Oh, I love all the research you've done and how well you've explained it, because I feel like I'm benefiting. Oh, I'm doing that ritual travel thing you were talking about earlier. But in a sort of educational way. Let's talk about some of the hits, I guess, of Indonesian cuisine, although it is a very varied and regional cuisine. What would you say are like the kind of best known favorites?
Sure. So there are five national dishes of Indonesia.
I
think the Ministry of Food and Tourism kind of named them as the national dishes. And so one of them is nasi goreng, which is an Indonesian fried rice. And really what sets it apart from other fried rice that people might be familiar with is it is like a punch in the face of flavor is the best way I could describe it. It is like I think it's not a side, it's a main meal, nasi goreng. And it's often made with a really lovely spice paste. So, you know, it could be as simple as just, you know, garlic, shallots and ginger, let's say. And then it's seasoned with a mix of some lovely Indonesian seasoning. So ketchup manis might be one of them, with a fermented sweet soy sauce, maybe some soy sauce or shrimp paste. And it just becomes this wonderful umami laden dish, and usually with a frilly fried egg on top. So that's that's one of the main dishes. Then you've got satay, which can be, you know, there's hundreds of variations of satay. You've got chicken satay, prawn satay, you've got tofu satay, you know, so many different types, lots of vegetable satays. You've also got soto, again, lots of different varieties, which is a soup basically. And you can have it with beef or chicken or, you know, lots of different varieties as well. Rendang is a gorgeous caramelized beef curry, which basically it's from West Sumatra, but it is made with, you know, cuts of beef that need to be cooked, you know, stewing beef, I guess you would say, in a broth of coconut milk and a spice paste. And it's cooked for, you know, a minimum of 3 hours simmering in a giant wok, and then until it's all of the sauce has basically evaporated and reduced to kind of sediment. And it is just one of the most wonderful dishes, you know, you could ever really eat. And then did I say five?
But anyway, cooking
that's okay. Delicious. And the other one is gado-gado. Sorry.
For that yes.
Which is peanut sauce on a cooked vegetable salad. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so delicious. So those are like the five that are very well known, but then there are so many dishes.
There's so many,
which are, you know, many of which I've put into my book, that, you know, people have never really heard of, and, you know, particular islands that they've never visited or heard of in Indonesia, you know, like Timor, where my dad is from, or Sulawesi, which is such a wonderful culinary destination, which is, you know, gorgeous food from there. And obviously there's Bali, which everyone knows, or Jakarta, which is the capital. But, you know, there is so much more to Indonesia than, I guess, you know, what people might be familiar with.
Well, let's talk a lot more about that right after a quick little commercial break. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Cheeselandia is a community for loud and proud cheese lovers brought to life by Wisconsin cheese. I know that I can always cook amazing food with their cheese, and it's even good enough just to snack on. As a Cheeselandia member, I know there is always a supportive community behind me who always gets as excited as I do about cheese. Go to cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up. Check us out on Instagram at Cheeselandia.
All right, we're chatting more with Laura Lee. She is the author of Coconut and Sambal, one of the best cookbooks of the year, according to everyone, including me.
They're lovely.
I'm like just salivating over every single image, every single description. You mentioned your father's from Timor. There's a Timorese fish soup that just looks so fresh and springy, but very refreshing with this hake or cod into big chunks, and Thai basil, just so beautiful. There's such a range of dishes in here. I wanted to ask you, how did you research all of this?
Yes, it's a lot. and also I live in London, where there's a very small community of Indonesians that live here as well. So I guess my journey really started in London, and I knew that I wanted to write this cookbook, and so I entered a competition. It was a cookbook writing competition, actually, cookbook proposal. So I entered a competition, and that was like the first draft of Coconut and Sambal that kind of was put out there, and I came runner up in that competition. So nice. I had a bit of encouragement I felt encouraged to continue the idea that I was onto something. So, but I was a little bit sad I didn't win. So my husband,
you're determined.
I was determined. Yeah. So my husband said, "Why don't you reach out to Sri Owen, who is she's based in London. She is, by the way, the doyen of Indonesian cookery. She's
okay.
A grandmother of Indonesian food. She introduced Indonesian food to the world, I think in the 1980s, and she did for Indonesian food what Julia Child kind of did for French cuisine. She wrote the first English speaking cookbook about Indonesian food, and she lives in London, not too far away from me. So I emailed her, and she's 85 now, but when I emailed her, I think she was 81 or 82, and she wrote back straight away, very tech savvy. And she said, "Come to my house on Saturday." And so I rang her doorbell a few days later, and she's 4'10". She's tiny, teeny tiny. And she just said, she put an apron over my head, told me to wash her hands, and then announced that we were cooking an Indonesian banquet for about 12 guests that were coming for lunch. And so she kind of set me on my voyage for training on learning Indonesian food under her tuition, because it was incredible, because I grew up in Australia. There's a large Indonesian community there. I have aunties and my grandmother lived with us, and so I was exposed to a lot of Indonesian food, but my grandmother passed away 20 years ago, so I didn't really have her as a reference point to be able to recreate her recipes, or to have someone close to me that I could just kind of speak to all the time about Indonesian food. So I met Sri weekly, and she kind of passed all of her knowledge down to me in this incredible kind of, over the course of about 12 months. And then amazingly, the cookbook proposal I was working on, and I got signed to a publisher, Bloomsbury. And then after that, I spent 6 months traveling across Indonesia, meeting with family members and relearning my grandmother's recipes with my aunties. So my grandmother had written a couple of recipe books that was incredible. So we referenced her handwritten recipe books that must have been 50 years old. My aunties taught me their recipes. And then I also followed my nose across Indonesia from, the west of Sumatra to the east in Timor, and just kind of dotted around all of the different islands. And I would meet a random taxi driver and ask him if he knew anyone that was a good home. Or I would go to food markets and say, "I'm really wanting to learn this particular regional dish, a special dish from a particular place." And the person at the food market would kind of text their cousin, who then would meet me the next day. And it was just this wonderful process of these warm, generous Indonesians,
That's
really
great.
Thrilled and excited and so proud to teach this, you know, they kept calling me the British chef. And even though I'm like, I'm like half Indonesian, but they were like, the British chef has come to town, you know, oh we must goodness. All... We must all teach her, the, you know, our recipes. I mean, it was just so sweet. And it, I think it helped also. My husband is 6'6" and he's British, and he wore a cowboy hat for a lot of the trip. And every people just thought that was amazing. So I think they wanted him in their house more than they wanted me, actually. But yeah, it was pretty funny. Cool.
That's, but that's really great.
That's really how I collected and curated the book, really. I just kind of followed my nose. And I had quite a few experts that Sri Owen had introduced me to, so some ambassadors of the cuisine.
Right.
And also, you know, acted as a really lovely guide and mentor. People like William Wongso, if anyone's heard of that name. He's the godfather of Indonesian cuisine, and Sri Owen's like the grandmother. So they're both kind of like the top dogs of the cuisine, really. But yeah, I felt very, very lucky in terms of how generous Indonesians are and how, you know, how hospitable they are. And I think that's just, it comes with the culture. They're just the most kind and giving people. So yeah,
that's,
they were happy,
fabulous.
To help.
Mm. Well, I think we're very lucky to have a cookbook that envelops all that knowledge that you're able to glean from, you know, everyone from your family members to these experts and every place in between. It's really special. I also want to mention that, like, the photography here, it's just so beautiful, and it really gives you that virtual vacation. And you mentioned that you grew up in Sydney, and, you know, growing up, your grandmother, Popo, would basically kind of bring a taste of Indonesia to you because you didn't really travel there when you were a kid, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So what was it like the first time you went to Indonesia?
Oh, it was incredible, because I was about 21 years old, and we went to both Bali and Timor, and quite amazingly, my grandmother's house where my dad grew up is still standing in the old town of Timor. And if I can kind of compare Bali to Timor, Bali is very much built for tourists, and it is wonderful. People go on honeymoons there. But, you know, if you want a flat white, or if you want, you know, to go to yoga, or you want to, you know, have a kind of, you know, a postcard vacation, Bali is fantastic for that.
Okay.
And it has a traditional scene as well. But when you go to a place like Timor, that for me feels more like, you know, the real local Indonesia, because you know, it's so what I love about it is, you know, the roads are dusty, the street food is just filled with all of the locals. You know, you hear the call to prayer in the morning. My grandmother's house didn't have a flushing toilet. You know, it's very much what you know, real Indonesian life. This is the Indonesian life that, you know, there's 280 million Indonesians that live in Indonesia, and this is the life that most Indonesians lead. And for me, when I first went to Timor, the thing that kind of struck me first was the incredible sunsets, because the sun is so huge as it sets over the Savu Sea in Timor. But I visited my grandmother's house for the first time, and when I stepped through the door, it was shocking to feel how similar we were, because her house was I call it a rainbow house, because every single room was colored a different bright color. So she had a kitchen that was like a gorgeous kind of really like a sky blue, azure blue, I guess you would call it. And, you know, the stairwell was blue, the sink was blue, this hose pipe was blue, the tiles
were
blue.
That's so cool. There's a photo of it in the book.
Yes. Yeah. And my grandmother's bedroom is lime green with like a bright pink, like chicken statue, a Jesus statue, a cat statue. I mean, it's like, it's just so eclectic. And, you know, the walls were crumbling, but a bright purple, and every room was a different color. And then we found her recipe books. We found her old photo albums of my dad when he was a baby that I'd never seen before. And so I guess for me, it was, you know, this feeling of going into the past and entering a world that I'd only ever heard about through stories from my aunties or my grandmother or my father. And it also felt completely familiar, like, you know, walking on the beach in Kupang, which is where my dad grew up. That's the city of West Timor where he grew up. you know, it just felt like I felt like I had come home, and that's the only way I can describe it. I consider Australia is my home, but there's so much about Indonesia that feels like it's part of my, you know, my heart and soul is from there. You know, it just it felt so, and I really understood. I think I'd spent my entire life, you know, trying to understand who I was, in the sense of, you know, I'm half Australian, I'm half, you know, Chinese Indonesian, and I finally understood that half of my identity. I felt like everything suddenly made sense. And, you know, the way my dad has that kind, generous, warming hospitality. He's so selfless with others. And seeing how Indonesians treat others, just my dad made sense to me.
It clicked, yeah.
And I think the other thing for me, which was really special, was to see, you know, my dad is in Australia. You would call him a very shy person. You know, he's got some very close friends who are Indonesian, part of his Indonesian community. But, you know, otherwise he's quite, he's very introverted. He's very, very shy when he meets people. And seeing him on his home turf, on his terms, in his territory, my dad became this extrovert, speaking the language he was born learning, and you know, seeing old friends and old family members, and as a different side of my family of my dad I'd never seen before. So for me, that was the most special moment of all, really, seeing my dad shine and, you know, be his complete and true self. And that, you know, that's something that is just, yeah, it was really beautiful to watch.
That's so special to share. When did you know that you wanted to do a cookbook to sort of pay tribute to this heritage of yours?
I think when I moved to London 9 years ago, I really felt the absence of Indonesian food because it's so accessible in Australia. It's a 6-hour flight to get there. And then there's Indonesian restaurants. You know, they're plentiful. I think there's 40 or 50 in Sydney alone. There's a lot in Melbourne and so on. So there's quite a lot of Indonesian, you know, there's a big Indonesian community, Indonesian supermarkets. So coming to London, there's 2 Indonesian restaurants. I didn't know any of the community. I couldn't, you know, I didn't know where to find the ingredients I wanted to buy. And so I think it was kind of this slow burn from when I moved to London to roughly about, I think it was 2017 that I entered that cookbook writing competition. But the idea was kind of simmering for a little while before that. And I was really, really wanting to connect with, I guess, you know, I learned Indonesian as a language when I was little, and then we stopped speaking it when I was, after my grandmother moved back to Indonesia, we stopped speaking it. And my parents made a decision to do that, you know, for, I guess, reasons where they wanted us in their mind to fit in. And that, I know it's really sad to stop speaking it in that way. And so, for me, you know, I started learning Indonesian again, and, you know, it all started to come back, and there were kind of these kind of baby steps kind of getting to this point. And then when I had committed to doing it, I deep dived head first, all in, and it was, you know, the most wonderful, the greatest process to write the book and to research and to realize, you know, you don't know how much you don't know until you start researching something like this. And I'm in awe of Indonesian cuisine, and I feel like the cookbook has only scratched the surface for me. Like, there's so much more to learn about Indonesian cookery, and I'm fascinated by it. So, I mean, even now post cookbook, I'm constantly pitching article ideas to different magazines to write about different Indonesian foods or produce, or, you know, kind of trying to, for me, I find it really interesting to learn as well. So, and I want to promote it and continue to promote it. So, but yeah, I think it was kind of been, I guess, three years in the making, you know, properly really focused on it.
Do you think, were you surprised by the showering of support it has gotten since it came out? And I know it's flying off the shelves. Like, I could barely get a copy of it myself.
Honestly, I can't believe it. So COVID came out in, was it March? Mm-hmm. Yeah, early March. And I just said to my husband, oh no, the book's going to get buried. And, you know, because you pour your whole heart and soul and all your love into a project like this. And I thought, oh no, it's going to get buried. But I was like, oh, you know, at least, you know, I'm proud of it. It's okay. You know, but like a little bit kind of heartbroken and not really knowing what that meant for a cookbook. But, you know, I mean, people have, and I think this goes for so many cookbooks that have been released, you know, at the moment, like In Bibi's Kitchen is another wonderful one that people have really embraced. And I think people, it's really resonated with a lot of people, because I think I'm not isolated in this journey of, you know, being a child of an immigrant, feeling disconnected from, you know, part of my heritage or my identity, and wanting to discover that and relearn it and come to terms with who, you know, food is very much, you know, who, for many of us, it's who we are as people. It can define us. And for me, that's a big part of how I connected to my heritage. So I think a lot of people have kind of really, like, it's kind of captured their imaginations in terms of, you know, how they might feel as, you know, people that might live far from home or mm-hmm. their parents have immigrated. So, yeah, I mean, I've been completely shocked at, you know, how people have received it. But, I mean, every time something happens, I kind of pinch myself, because I'm still slightly in disbelief about it all. But, you know, it's just been, it makes me so happy to see, you know, when people tag me on social media and they've cooked my food and it's given them it's given them a little bit of hope in what has been a really terrible year for a lot of us. You know, it really does give me so much joy and happiness to see that. And I'm really grateful that people have embraced it as much as they have.
Fantastic. Well, it's about all the time we have today, but I'm sure we could go on forever. We didn't even scratch the surface of all the dishes in here, which happens to include some of Barack Obama's favorite foods, like this meatball soup. We didn't even get to.
Oh, bakso. It's called bakso. And yes, it's delicious. Yes, it's so good. Oh my goodness. Yes, that is such a good soup.
But Laura, thank you so much for sharing your journey and making this cookbook. Thank you so much for taking this on. It's a really great cookbook to have, and a great piece of culture to share. And thank you so much for all your hard work on it. And I can't wait to cook out of it really, really soon.
Oh, thank you so much, Kathy. It's been really fun. And I love, by the way, like your books, The Food of Taiwan and Chicken Chicken. I mean, honestly, I think you need to have a show where you interview yourself.
I feel like I am right now, because we have an uncanny amount of things in common.
We do.
Laura, it's kind of... Yes. It's kind of cool.
Yes, I know. But yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, and thank you so much for taking the time, and hope you're having a great evening across the pond where it's nighttime now. And
It's bedtime for my son, but my husband's got it, so he's got it in the bag, so that's good. I get the night off. Perfect.
Well, congrats on the book. I hope everyone gets their hands on Coconut and Sambal from Bloomsbury. Thank you to Jeet Suresh Paul, our engineer today. And I guess that's the last time we'll hear from you in 2020. So hope you have a great end of year. And thanks, everyone. See you next year.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. I also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.